Welcome to the 9th episode of Indestructible Podcast, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a joint effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. The transcript for this episode is available exclusively to our patrons, as are they all for all the other episodes. If you'd like to financially support this podcast, please visit patreon.com/indestructiblepod. As an independent media project, we are extremely thankful to our patrons. If you are listening to this podcast for the first time and enjoy its content, please like and share it on social media. You will find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, while all our content can be found on our homepage at alborada.net/indestructible. In this episode, I speak with Joe Emmersberg and Justin Prodeux, who are the authors of Extraordinary Threat, The U.S. Empire, The Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela, published earlier this year by Monthly Review Press. This work looks at key issues on Venezuela, some of which include the country's electoral system, the issue of human rights, and the economic record under harsh U.S. sanctions of the current leftist coalition that has been in power since 1999, when the late President Hugo Chavez first won office. Joe Emmersberg is an engineer, writer, and activist based in Canada, while Justin Prodeux is an associate professor on the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University. Justin is the author of several books, some of which include Haiti's New Dictatorship, Siege Breakers, and America's War on Democracy in Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. I now leave you with Joe Emmersberg and Justin Prodeux. Joe Emmersberg, thank you very much for joining Indestructible Podcast. I understand Justin's going to be joining us a little bit later. I have invited you and Justin because I think together you have written one of the most important books on Venezuela in recent years. Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 Years of Coup Attempts in Venezuela. Before we commence an in-depth discussion on this work, could you briefly tell our audience your own background, your interest in Latin America, and finally, what motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, well, I'm of Ecuadorian roots. My mother's from Ecuador. I've been back and forth to Ecuador all my life, so always had, for that reason, a very strong interest in Latin America. I've always spoke Spanish in the house. My wife's from Ecuador. I met her. So I've always had felt strong links that, through Ecuador, obviously, but to the whole region. And ever since I was a teenager, followed politics, not just in Nicaragua was a hot topic when I was, growing up as a teenager, first became politically aware, basically around 1979. So my first two political interests revolved around Nicaragua and the hostage crisis in Iran. At the time, those kind of things that happened during the Reagan era. So that's how I got, I got drawn into Latin American politics in general. And Venezuela in particular is just such an incredibly hopeful example. After the neoliberal 80s and 90s, Chavez wins an election, and obviously starts, elements of the left international maybe doubting him at first because he was from the military and everything, but obviously goes forward with a very progressive agenda domestically and internationally, and just the level of dishonesty and vitriol he was subjected to right from the get-go, that was so amazing, because here was a country that was extremely democratic. If anything, it was too tolerant of a seditionist opposition. And yet it has been smeared successfully now as a dictatorship, was for a long time while Chavez was in office, and even more so with the economic crisis that took place under Maduro. So that's what made it such a compelling case study. And Justin also has done a lot of work around Latin America. He was a Colombia Solidarity office. He'll be joining us shortly. So we both got together and said, this is a book that we can go through and thoroughly debunk the lies that have been told about this country for the last 20 years.
Your book, Extraordinary Threat, covers several themes, but mainly concentrates on several coup attempts against the democratically elected governments of the late President Hugo Chavez and the incumbent President Nicolas Maduro since 1999, when Chavez came to office. What did Venezuela look like before 1999, and what role did it play as a geopolitical ally of the United States?
Yeah, you know, before we talk about this in our chapter four, where we debunk this trope that's been hauled out repeatedly, especially since 2014, that it's the once prosperous term that's thrown out constantly about Venezuela. It's often used very vaguely. They don't often tell you when exactly Venezuela was prosperous. But it was, you know, from the 1958 until Chavez was elected, you could say it was under this system. It was referred to as a punto fijo, where a few dominant political parties basically swapped the highest office and maintained the United States and maintained Venezuela as a democracy with extreme limitations. You know, by the time Chavez was elected in 1998 and took office in 1999, Venezuela had a 50% poverty rate. And that's despite the fact that it had been a major oil exporter since the 1930s. And it wasn't until the 70s that the big exporters like Iran and Saudi Arabia actually surpassed it in production. So it had this tremendous amount of wealth that basically just evaporated. And what we show in the book is that even at its peak, let's say during the 70s oil boom, when it was one of the most prosperous times, or, you know, relative to other times in its history, it was still mired with tremendous inequality and injustice. It still had like twice the child mortality rate that Cuba had, that does not have Venezuela's oil wealth. And on top of that, subjected to this, you know, over 60-year blockade by the United States. And also, you know, there's another key thing that exposed the rot, let's say, in Venezuela's political culture, was the 1999 Caracazo massacre. And we talk about the fact that, you know, it's a massacre that happened over a 5-day period. They implemented a brutal IMF imposed austerity package that caused led to mass riots, uprising against it by the poorest people in Caracas and in Venezuela. And over a 5-day period, nobody's certain exactly what the death toll is. It goes from hundreds to possibly as high as 3,000. It seems like 1,500 is a number a lot of people tend to agree on. But over that 5-day period, when they were, you know, that massacre, while that massacre was still taking place, President George Bush Sr. called the president of Venezuela at the time, Carlos Andres Perez, and commiserated with him. You know, sorry, you're going through this, and offered him loans, you know, to help him out through this hard time when he was massacring his own people. So that kind of shows you the kind of tight relationship Venezuela had with the United States government. And also, and we Winch mentioned the book, is that the media coverage was basically not even impacted by the Caracazo massacre. It continued to receive flattering. The president of Venezuela who perpetrated the massacre continued to receive very flattering press coverage in outlets like the New York Times. So that it's basically just an oligarchy, really, with some democratic forms and close relationship with the United States, and therefore given free rein to massacre its own people without suffering any consequences whatsoever. So of course, when the Chavismo takes over, everything turns around. Suddenly they're looking for any excuse they can to paint the government as authoritarian and repressive and everything else.
The Bolivarian Revolution has been in power in Venezuela for 22 years. My understanding is that in November, it will hold the 29th election. During the majority of those elections, different sections of the opposition, because I think it's important to stress that there are many oppositions, have participated while others have chosen not to. Before we discuss the opposition and their actions, what would you say have been the broad policies of the Bolivarian Revolution, which has seen it establish such strong support amongst Venezuela's most disenfranchised sectors?
Yeah, I think the key time, you know, there's a documentary that came out just recently by and this economist Ricardo Hausmann. In this documentary, he hates Chavismo. He was with the government that perpetrated the Caracazo massacre. But he says that after 5 years of Chavez, in his documentary, he says after 5 years of Chavez, the economy didn't improve. You know, that's actually true. But what he doesn't mention is it didn't improve because there were two major coup attempts backed by the United States. One, the first one in April of 2002, briefly successful, ousted Chavez for 2 days, but he returned thanks to a mass uprising and a loyalist sector of the military that put him back in power. And then there was several months later, a really devastating oil strike. Basically, it was an upper management lockout of the state oil company that spiked poverty all the way up over 60%. So it cost the country billions of dollars, and it was devastating to the economy. So yeah, by the first 5 years of Chavez's government, in spite of his popular support, if you just look at the economic indicators, yeah, they were worse, because in order to start delivering benefits, they had to survive this incredible assault backed by Washington, 100%. They had to survive that and defeat that, and they did. So that's one thing that's important to mention, because you know there's what Chavez did subsequently. You know, he reduced poverty by half, extreme poverty by two-thirds, and that came after, because fortunately oil prices continued to rise after he defeated the coup attempt. However, what's important to recognize is that, you know, how did it look to Venezuelans that this opposition backed by Washington basically engaged in this scorched earth policy attempt to prevent any progress from being made? You know, so I think a lot of the credibility of Chavismo, the durability of Chavismo, is linked to its own achievements in the past and in the present, but also to just the repulsive nature of the opposition that they've been confronted with in Venezuela. So that's another thing we try to make people understand, you know, because you know, the opposition is not just the Maduro government, the Chavez government, for is vilified, but also that the U.S. backed opposition is totally whitewashed. You know all the things they should answer for, they're never made to answer for in the corporate media's coverage.
And of course, we have to remember, I mean, once Chavismo was able to defeat the 2002 coup and the oil lockout, then a lot of the government's policies in terms of health and education kicked in. That's when I think the Cuban doctors and medical people arrived, and benefits were delivered to a substantial
Sure, and that's also why you know, we mentioned why Chavez had to you know, really get aggressive with his own media. His presence in the media had to be amplified just to tell people what's available, because otherwise people wouldn't even know what benefits were available. You know, and you know, the medical establishment, they were on strike against Chavez as early as 2001, you know, and the head of the largest medical federation in Venezuela, he actually signed the Carmona decree, Douglas Natera, Dr. Douglas, he actually signed the Carmona decree. He's one of the signers. The Carmona decree is a decree that Pedro Carmona, he was the businessman who declared himself president during the April 2002 coup. And one of the first things he did after he declared himself president was issue this decree that dissolved the Supreme Court, dismissed all the elected officials throughout the country. It was just a wacko a dictatorial proclamation, and it was signed by a whole bunch of leading lights of the Venezuelan opposition, and they're always reminded of that by Chavismo. It's always thrown back in the face over the years, you know. And the head of the medical establishment was one of them. So it just shows you they had to. We try to bring this out in the book that they had a Chavismo. Its opposition came not just from the oligarchy, let's say, but also from a lot of the professional class. You know, they had to, that's where it was crucial to bring in Cubans to deliver services that would otherwise have been very difficult to deliver.
And before I move on to the next question, just a short digression, but I'm often looking for articles in the mainstream media on the housing program that the government has. And I've been to Venezuela many times, and it's amazing. You see entire apartment complexes being built for the poor, construction taking place everywhere, And this is almost never reported in the mainstream press. And when it is, they critique that, you know, some of these buildings haven't been, these housing projects haven't been finished on time. It's all terrible. There's almost no credit given to either Chavez or Maduro for their popular policies, which have benefited a significant amount of average, Venezuelan. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. You know, and it's one thing we mentioned. We have a whole chapter dedicated to Rory Carroll of The Guardian, because he happened to be...
I have a question.
Yeah, okay. Sure. Well, I mean, I can wait if you prefer. I can wait for the question if you prefer.
I have a question.
Okay, hold off.
Okay, so your book is absolutely scathing of the majority of Venezuela's opposition, which you accuse of attempting multiple coups d'etats against Presidents Chavez and Maduro. When discussing the 2002 coup, which saw President Chavez briefly kidnapped and replaced by Pedro Carmona, the head of the largest business federation, you write, and I quote, "There is no reason to doubt that what would have happened to anybody in the United States involved in a coup that kidnapped a US president. There would be no second attempt by the same domestic and international actors. Moreover, there is no legitimate reason why an elected government should be expected to tolerate a violent opposition, especially one backed by foreign muscle. Indeed, this impossible expectation seems to apply only to US enemies," end quote. Could you elaborate on this point and discuss some of these multiple coup attempts, please?
Well, sure. We go over the six major ones and they're all by the same actors. For instance, one of the key players involved in pretty much all of them is Leopoldo Lopez. Right? He's been declared a prisoner. He's not in prison. He's escaped. He's in Spain now. But when he was incarcerated in Venezuela, finally in 2014, he was called a prisoner of conscience by Amnesty International. That's the outfit that still refuses to say that Assange is a political prisoner, never said that Chelsea Manning was a political prisoner when she was in jail. So it's just ridiculous. But yeah, I'm just saying that because he's one of the, you know, it's basically the same cast of characters in every one of these coup attempts. There was the April 2002 coup attempt where they were successful for 2 days. They actually overthrew Chavez, got him out of office for 2 days, you know, issued this Carmona decree, which I already discussed, but then that collapsed. But then several months later, there was a second major attempt, which was the so-called oil lockout, which was devastating to the economy. And one of the key protests linked to oil strike, one of the sparks that initiated was a protest in this plaza, which was in the municipality governed by Leopoldo Lopez. Was basically the defeated coup mongers from the previous coup attempt who staged a protest daily in this plaza. And so after that, neither Lopez and other politicians do not go to jail for it. And then subsequently they tried through legal means to unseat Chavez to a recall referendum 2004. That fell apart. But basically, when he defeated the oil strike, and with oil prices rising suddenly, and with the help of the Cubans, you know, to defeat some of the professional class attempts to boycott his government, basically Chavez was able to, for several years, develop major improvements in healthcare and education and voting turnout, pretty much a whole slew of metrics. Even the Human Development Index of the UN, it's one of the countries that made the most ground, you know, by 2012. So it had a tremendous, and in fact, even by GDP per capita, it came very close, not quite, but very close to what it was to its peak from the late 1970s. So by almost any metric you can think of, Venezuela was just full steam ahead, rapidly progressing on numerous fronts. And of course, you know, winning elections at the same time because of that. So for a long time, you know, the opposition kind of cooled it, so to speak, in terms of major coup attempts. But then when Chavez passes away, at the same time, you know, Venezuela's economy runs into problems. And then there's right off the bat in 2013, Enrique Capriles, the opposition candidate, again, he was also involved with the coup d'etat, the first two coup attempts. He declares, he says there's fraud. He's backed, the United States backs him up, of course. He calls for protests. They kill like nine people, and but he calls them off. But, you know, Leopoldo Lopez publicly said, no, he shouldn't have called them off. He should have kept going. Probably he'd be president today if he had just kept going. So that's like the third attempt. It was not as serious as the other, the first two, but it was still, you know, you have a superpower backing you up, and you're saying the elections were rigged against you. And so right off the bat, they're back to the same tactics they were using before. And this is before there's really any economic crisis. The economy had slowed, there were some problems, but there was no recession yet. Similarly, 2014, shortly after the opposition received a pretty decisive defeat, or quite decisive defeat in municipal elections nationwide, a few months later, Leopoldo Lopez leads these another batch of guarimbas, you know, violent street protests designed to basically bring up, you know, through violence, through provocations designed to bring about a response from the government, which then gets, you know, depicted through the Western media as repression, and it worked. You know, the United States again backs him up. So it's again the same cast of characters, always with the support of the United States throughout this whole time, receiving received millions of dollars a year directly from the United States in funding through USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, that whole soft power network. Yes, they're always getting funded by the United States. They're getting publicly supported by the United States. So in 2014, they launched these, like I said, these street protests. They leave like 40 people dead, roughly split between government supporters and opposition. And then that's the fourth attempt to try to unseat the government in illegal ways, and then in 2017, you know, Venezuela is entering a very serious economic crisis. So by 2017, they launch another round of street protests. Now by this time, finally, Leopoldo Lopez was finally in jail, but it was again the same cast of characters as from, you know, basically throughout the whole period. And in even Leopoldo Lopez, even from jail, somehow he was issuing videos and statements supporting the street protests. But and these were even more serious. They left like like 126 people dead. It's not clear exactly how it breaks down, because a lot of the deaths at that time were disputed, and also the Ministerio Público, the public prosecutor, was Luisa Ortega Diaz. By that time, she was already making it clear that she was turning against the government. And since a lot of the data, the investigation comes from her ministry, it's actually probably skewed towards the opposition. It's not clear, but it's probably split more or less the same as it was in 2014. And then after that, you know, Trump ramps up these financial sanctions, which are incredibly devastating, you know, basically intensifies Obama's sanctions. And then by 2019, you get the sixth major coup attempt, which is still ongoing. It's basically what you'd call the Guaido era, you know, with the recognition of Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela, that gave the United States grounds to intensify the sanctions even more, because now they basically, that was the legal basis for essentially imposing an oil embargo, then a complete total embargo on anything from Venezuela, just a whole, and then secondary sanctions on people who deal with them, just a whole raft of ever escalating economic sabotage and warfare against the Venezuelan government. And also along with that, you know, from Trump, especially direct insinuation that he could possibly even take military action against the government. So, yeah, so those were basically six what we call coup attempts that we discuss in detail in our book. And it's, again, always by the same cast of characters, always supported completely by the United States. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting as well that they will participate in the elections when they think that they can obtain electoral victories, but when it's quite clear that they're not going to win the expected seats at the National Assembly, they withdraw and cry foul and say, well, the conditions are not acceptable for us to participate in Venezuela's electoral system. And of course, the United States backs that. I'm just interested in some of the sort of smaller, if you have any information for us in terms of some of the smaller in the sense of the broader picture, there's still quite serious assassination attempts. For example, I remember a few years ago, I think it was 2018 or 19, there was an attempt to kill Maduro using drones and they exploded quite close to him. We have, of course, Silvercorp, a U.S. mercenary company, which I think was tied to someone in the Venezuelan business community. I mean, are these sort of desperate attempts on the part of the Venezuelan opposition, sort of harebrained schemes? What's your reflection on some of these other plots which are taking place?
Yeah, you know, it's almost hard to classify them after 2019. It's so flagrant. You know, like the whole recognition of Guaido as interim president, like I said, that was the grounds for this even more economic sabotage. But within that period, you know, you have things like you mentioned, the Silvercorp mercenary so-called invasion, which was a farce, you know. You also had Guaido a few months after he was declared interim president, standing outside a military base in Caracas, saying that Leopoldo Lopez was with him. He was led to believe that the military was about to turn. And within a few hours, that was exposed as a total joke. You know, nothing was going to happen. And, you know, so there's a bunch of things like that happening that you could also, I guess you could quibble. There are also coup attempts, you know, so you could say, but it's almost hard to classify it because now the provocations are so serious that you could almost call every little thing they do another coup attempt because, you know, it just gets ridiculous after a while. The mercenary thing was interesting because Pompeo, his denial of that was to say, his exact words, the United States has no direct involvement. I mean, he put the qualifier direct in that. So he's admitting that, yeah, we were indirect. Of course, we were indirectly involved. I mean, that's just plain. Everybody sees that, right? And, you know, there's other things, you know, like you have the links between Guaido and the paramilitaries in Colombia, you know, who just, he's being photographed with armed, you know, guys standing, paramilitary drug dealers, known gangs, gang members of these drug traffickers who have horrific human rights track records, and they're standing next to him armed. Like, how does a drug trafficker get next to you armed, fully armed? Like, why would anyone let them that close unless he was known and trusted by your team? And what does that say, you know? And so it goes on and on. I mean, it's so mafioso, like, you know, the way they operate. You know, during the when in 2019 when the United States tried to basically ram so-called aid through the Colombian border, that was a major provocation. A lot of people thought at the time maybe this was going to be a U.S. invasion. You know, they were trying to, guys like Bolton and Pompeo and Marco Rubio were tweeting directly at Venezuela's high command saying, look, you know, if you don't let this aid in, you know, you're going to end up in prison. Think of your family. They're making, you know, just so obvious that they're trying to incite a coup. And we talk about this in the book. And what the military held firm, they didn't fall for the provocation. They didn't turn on Maduro. And but you could call that, again, you could call that another major coup attempt. A lot of people at the time, people contacted me in Venezuela saying, oh, you know, people are very frightened that there's going to be an invasion. It was that serious, you know, but the military stood up to it. And but it just goes on and on. These provocations are just constant, you know. Now you could call it almost every incident, you could pick one a month almost and say it's a coup attempt, you know. But for us, we just put it all inside the whole Guaido era, which is still, although he's lost, it seems it's pretty obvious that he's lost credibility with the United States. And obviously with the Europeans who don't even officially recognize him as interim president anymore, but he's it's still, I would say, his era is still not completely over. It could end, but who knows?
I'm surprised at how well the Venezuelan military has managed to keep itself intact. Because if we look at things as sort of a broader historical perspective, we go back to the Allende era. Of course, in Nicaragua, there was a full-blown revolution. So you had a new armed forces for Nicaragua, the same in Cuba. But I'm still surprised at the enormous pressure and how resilient the Venezuelan military has become. And I think that if Chavez himself had not come from the military, it's most likely that the hard right in Venezuela, these fascists, would have overthrown the Bolivarian Revolution. Now, the support sections of Venezuela's most hard right opposition has received, of course, from the United States is impressive. Whether it is through millions of dollars by the National Endowment for Democracy, favorable media coverage, which ignores their violence, and I think even quite open sort of racist statements, or their recognition for Guaido on January 23rd, 2019, who declared himself as the country's I think interim president was the title. Could you elaborate on these links and the links that I'm thinking of specifically? Are the ones between the Venezuelan opposition and the United States, the U.S. Backing. And I'm also interested in why Caracas hasn't taken a harsher stance, because I know that many elements within Chavismo have said, well, why is Guaido still walking around the streets of Caracas when, he makes a statement and he's surrounded by a very small minor section of the armed forces which defected with him, and trying to stage a coup. I mean, why did it take so long to arrest Leopoldo López? We have the amnesty after 2002, which took place, and Capriles, we know that he surrounded the Cuban embassy, attacked the Cuban embassy. I mean, when you start looking at the actions of these characters, again, in a Western democracy, they would be arrested and processed. So could you elaborate?
Yeah, I think one issue, there's many facts. I mean, part of it's strategic. I mean, your opposition is seditionist, but it's also backed by a superpower that's so much stronger than you militarily and economically, that obviously that constrains your ability to combat it the way you'd like to, right? The way you should be able to by rights. But just looking at the one thing we mentioned in our book is nobody talks about Article 1 of the Constitution. Venezuela is a sovereign country. It's entitled to, and it values its sovereignty. It's entitled to defend itself from foreign subversion. That's what any country should have. Any country should have the right to do that. But when you're up against a much stronger adversary, obviously your hands are tied to a large extent. And I think one thing we intimate in the book is that, with discussing Luis Arteaga Diaz, discussing that even through the golden years, let's say, of Chavismo, from 2004 to 2012, there was still this tremendous problem with impunity for Chavista activists in the countryside, especially, who were getting, hundreds were assassinated murders that strongly implicate wealthy landowners. And right off the bat, there was a problem there. There was an obvious problem there with the public prosecutors. And again, when you see later Luis Arteaga Diaz flip to the opposition and go from being this woman who never stopped praising Chavez to suddenly bad-mouthing Chavez, you see there's a lot of opportunists and hypocrites always within the ranks of Chavismo. But how does Chavez wage war on those kind of people within his own ranks? First of all, it's not always easy to identify them. Sometimes people just fool you. They pass themselves off as something they're not. But also, even if you know what they're up to, how do you wage a war within your own ranks when you're faced with a tremendously strong adversary abroad? And Chavez, well, actually, right from the beginning, Chavez was plagued with defections. The high-profile supporters very early on turned on him, went over to the opposition side because they probably thought the first two coup attempts would be as successful, And so there's all kinds of factors that I think it pressured Chavismo to kind of tolerate a certain, you know, corrupt opportunistic people within their own ranks that produced a lot of impunity for people like Lopez. We had to cut it from the book, but if you look at his trial, the way it was handled by the public prosecutors, it was very poorly done. It was like and then it wasn't surprising that they'd soon defect to the United States and say that, oh, we're sorry, we shouldn't have done this. They actually pursued his trial in a very weird way that kind of opened the government up to ridicule. And it was like this it was really like a fifth column almost. I would say the prosecutors, but then it goes back maybe more generally to professional class, you know, in general, that it's always a problem for any revolutionary movement to get professionals they can rely on who are actually going to stay true to a project that's about redistributing power. You know, it's kind of a challenge. So I think that's a factor that explains some of those things you're describing. But it ultimately stems from, you know, having this tremendously strong government that's against you and that has so many different ways that hurt you, you know. So when Guaido first in the first few months after his so-called interim presidency, I was of the opinion that, oh, come on, they can't let this guy walk around like that. This is crazy. They got to do something, you know. But actually, you know, in the long term, it looks like it was strategically, you know, wise to let him just burn himself out, let him just discredit himself, you know. And so it's remarkable that they're still standing. So I'm now more reluctant than ever to second guess them tactically, because they're up against a very ruthless superpower. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Okay, and I think we now have Justin with us.
Hey.
Hello, Justin. You can hear us fine.
Things liven up.
Yeah. How are you doing? Good morning to you, Rodrigo.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this ability, you know, this possibility to talk to you. As I've said to Joe, I think the book that both of you have put together is one of the most important books that has been written on Venezuela in a while. And there's always works that are coming out, but the majority, a real sort of critical systematic analysis is I think what you guys have done, looking at the attempts to overthrow the government in Venezuela. One aspect that I found quite interesting about your work was the online psychological war taking place against Venezuelan government officials. In one section, you quote U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, who tweeted directly to Venezuela's Director of Military Counterintelligence, stating, and I quote, at Ivan HD, you should think very carefully about the actions you take over the next few days in Venezuela, #Venezuela, because your actions will determine how you spend the rest of your life. Do you really want to be more loyal to Maduro than to your own family, end quote. Could you discuss this strategy by members of the US government, and how does it fit into sort of the broader framework to again overthrow the government in Caracas?
Well, I'll let Joe start.
Okay. Well, one thing there are many interesting aspects of that. One is that, you know, we put in our book, we put a chart showing the, at that time, you're talking about that tweet happened right around the time of the so-called aid stunt that we already discussed, when the United States was trying to ram aid through the border. It was a farce for many reasons, but it was obviously an attempt to test the loyalty of the military, to see if they'll turn on Maduro, to see if they'll overthrow him.
This is 2019.
Okay,
correct. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Go on, Joe.
Okay. And yeah, this is 2019. And so Rubio's tweeting that, but what we show in the book is that it's Rubio, it's Pompeo, it's I believe Pence, and one other official, I can't remember, but there's basically four of them. And you add up their tweets over these weeks of the aid stunt, it's like hundreds of tweets of this nature, just super bellicose, super, just unbelievably bold, right at the military, right at Maduro. You know, we're going to overthrow you. We're going to turn on you. It's just incredible. But what we point out is what's coming back from the Democrats, the so-called opposition in the United States, is basically nothing. I mean, basically nothing. One kind of mild tweet from that we point out from Tulsi Gabbard saying, you know, oh, we shouldn't do this. Yeah, just very, very weak. And then Bernie Sanders, you know, actually reinforcing the whole farce, you know, saying, oh, come on, Maduro, let the aid in. We put his exact words in the book, but basically that was the gist of his tweet. So just reinforcing. So what they said basically nothing, and what little they said, if anything, reinforced the whole thing. So it just shows you that the propaganda, it's crucial that liberals get on board, reinforce it, and that makes these, you know, the bloodthirsty maniacs and the Rubios, that makes them all the more effective, because there's nothing coming back at them, nothing that's stopping them, you know. So that's one really important aspect in our opinion.
Mm-hmm. Justin, your thoughts on this sort of psychological taking place against Venezuela and its officials?
Yeah, I mean, there's a contradiction. There's always a contradiction between the claim that we live in a world of sovereign countries, you know, that interact through some sort of international legal framework, and then these kinds of things, where it's an admission that, according to these people, they don't. Like, Rubio understands or thinks he understands that the U.S., some U.S. official, whatever the hell Rubio's formal job is, he's a member of this imperial elite, and he can tell individual officials in other governments what to do. And, you know, that you would think that would be some kind of affront, right? I mean, they wouldn't accept that. They would never accept that some other country, some official from some other country telling them what to do. And that's one part of it. The other part of it, you know, the other part of it in this world that's kind of strange about the world we live in is that it's not all despair, in the sense that it's also kind of pathetic, right? Like, you know, your subversion plan is to tweet at Venezuelan officials and ask them to step down. Like, if you're tweeting at an official hoping they're gonna betray they're gonna become traitors based on reading a tweet from Marco Rubio, the chances are you haven't done you know, the groundwork that is needed to pull off this kind of adventure. And that you know, maybe that groundwork, maybe you haven't done that groundwork because you're incompetent. I don't actually think that, you know, I think that comes through in our book. Like, we don't believe that the US is some kind of bumbling power at all, but, you know, it isn't easy to overthrow a revolution, even in a small country nearby with only one important industry. It's still hard if there's that level of consciousness and that level of, you know, what do you call it? Like, investment by the people in a project like the revolution, which is why they hate it so much. Mm-hmm. And which is why, you know, they tweet, you know, why they're reduced in a way to tweeting as a regime change operation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other thing we made fun of was John Bolton, in one of his press conferences around the time of the AIDS stunt. He holds up this yellow notebook like this, yeah. And it's got, you know, it has 5,000 Colombia troops from Colombia, and he holds it up so the press corps can see it. And then that's him thinking, I mean, the man actually thinking he's being clever or menacing in some way. Yeah. But it shows they have this tremendous hubris. I think, you know, it's not that they're not necessarily stupid, but this hubris that, you know, and I think part of that comes from what I mentioned before, they have no opposition. You know, they're not being threatened with legal action. There's no fear. They can just do what they want. There's nobody, no opposition party says, you know what, you're breaking the law, we're gonna throw you in jail for that.
I've thought for a long time that Venezuela's tragedy, you know, Venezuela's biggest problem is the fact that the opposition in Venezuela is so treasonous. Like, there's no there's no there's no opposition that's sort of like, hey, we oppose this policy and that policy, but we don't want to invite a foreign power to come and occupy this country and massacre all of the you know, people in the streets and in the government. Mm. You know, that would be great. It would be great if there was a so-called loyal opposition, right? Like, oppose the policies within the constitution. That's what Chavez has been begging the opposition to do for his whole career. But, you know, Joe keeps pointing out that an even bigger tragedy is the fact that there is no meaningful opposition of any kind in the US or in Western countries. Because, you know, those, like, when it comes to foreign policy, it's total consensus, just complete consensus on imperialism.
So. Yeah, they'll debate around the tactics. They'll debate around the
and
the
very tactics. Narrow, very yeah, narrow, very debate narrow. About tactics.
It's almost sort of the standard, you know, so it sort of fits into the broader pattern of Latin American history where elites, local elites, when they are challenged by popular movements, they run to Washington, obtain aid, pay off members of the military or simply just communicate with them. And then a coup d'etat takes place. And then the establishment order is reestablished. And in the case of Venezuela, since that hasn't happened, they haven't been able to psychologically change and say, okay, well, maybe we should adopt a different strategy. I thought that was going to, and maybe I was being completely naive, but I thought maybe there was going to be an opening, a slight change when Capriles ran against Maduro, and he made statements along the lines of, well, we have to concede that despite the fact that we may have disagreed with Chavez on just about everything, he did bring attention to the fact that there is a lot of poverty in Venezuela and certainly policies need to be implemented to address that mass poverty. But then, of course, when you read his program in depth, there was nothing really there to again, you know, try and win over the base of Chavismo to something different. Now, reading through the pages of your book, I couldn't help but remember the Washington Connection and Third World Fascism by Noam Chomsky and Edward S. Herman. In that book, which was part of a two-volume work, Chomsky and Herman discussed U.S. foreign policy and its support for brutal dictatorships in Latin America and Southeast Asia. While Chomsky and Herman relied on numerous human rights organizations to support some of the key claims in their work, your book, Extraordinary Threat, is highly critical of them and their hypocrisy towards Venezuela. You note, for example, the inability of Amnesty International and the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, Michelle Bachelet's inability to harshly condemn US economic sanctions against Venezuela. If numerous NGOs or high representatives of the United Nations have become co-opted by US power or are incapable of critiquing it, which organizations should we look towards to provide us with some accurate coverage of Venezuela?
Wow, that's a good question. I just want to say before we try to answer that question, which is a hard question in terms of it's not just where to look, but also how to look, right? The co-optation thing, like, I don't actually think it's a coincidence that, you know, Chomsky and Herman were able to rely on these organizations more, and then, you know, they've become more and more co-opted. It's an adaptation, right? So if opposition to imperial, if the opposition finds these things useful, the imperialists will look for a way to co-opt it. That's their way. Their way is to take over everything that might possibly threaten them. And human rights, you know, as Chomsky and Herman pointed out, like the consistent application of their own human rights framework, shows, you know, exposes their hypocrisy completely and exposes the lies of what they're, you know, what they're saying compared to what they're doing. So, yeah, it makes sense that they would bring a lot of that work in-house and, you know, have Human Rights Watch brought fully to heel and Amnesty, you know, basically co-opted and insert their people and their ideology into it. So, I think that that's a big part of why it's so hard to trust these organizations, and it's you know, and it's become almost hilarious, like they're quite ridiculous now. Like Ken Roth's behavior on Twitter is ridiculous. Like, he's a ridiculous figure, and like, he gets ridiculed often as well, rightly. He gets dragged, but you know, he just persists. There he is, he's out there, right? Because if you look up human rights on Google or whatever, these are the organizations that come up. So as for where to look, I mean, you know, we have like extensive thanks to Venezuela Analysis and some of our indie journalists. And, you know, I've come to a place now where, you know, again, it's become so ridiculous. You go on Twitter and they tag everything as state-owned media that isn't like a private monopoly U.S., you know, what do you call it? Craven U.S. ass-kissing media, right? And those are the only ones that are independent, the Washington Post and the New York Times and whatever. But so, like, from my perspective, like, that's told me, what that tells me is, like, it is important to check out those state media. You know, I almost now like see those warnings as like a sign that it's important to go on there. Like, let's go on RT and go on CGTN and go on whatever. Which one?
Press TV.
Yeah, go on Telesur. Like, just go, like, yeah. See what they have to say. At least they might have something different to say, and then you'll have some basis for comparison, some basis for critical thinking, because you'll have people saying genuinely different things. I kind of started that reading habit, you know, when I kind of realized, like, the New York Times is the worst. So if you read that, then you shouldn't have any kind of squeamishness around reading RT or, you know, Russian or Chinese or any other media, right? Why? Or Saudi, or for that matter, or Qatar, or Jazeera, whatever, Al Manar, wherever it is. Like, why be squeamish about it if you're reading the US mainstream genocidal media every day? So that's kind of, you know, that's why I said it's like how to read it, because you do have to be skeptical and critical and so on and understand where they're coming from. But yeah, I'm no longer, I would never tell anyone not to read a state affiliated media at this point.
I totally agree. It's very important to check out the sources that are demonized, not blindly, not just assume everything they say is true, but you have to have that balance. Because they're going to bring up facts, they're going to bring up interpretations that are missing and that are important. So if you're not looking at those sources, you're going to miss them. Because a lot of the most important lies the media tells are lies of omission. You know, they tell lies, but a lot of them is just, like I mentioned, when Ricardo Hausmann said in that documentary we talked about earlier, that after 5 years, Chavez did not improve the economy. That's true. It's not false. But what did they leave out? You know, that there were two major coup attempts, right? Yeah. So that's generally how the media operates. They'll tell you something that's true, but they'll leave out the important context. Now, sometimes they will lie too, but but you have to be looking always for those lies of omission. So that's why it's so important to check out the other sources. And you know, the human rights groups are it's unfortunate. They're more like, you should view them the same way you view the New York Times, the same way you view anybody else. They'll have the facts, but you have to be careful. What are they leaving out? What aren't they telling you? What are they distorting? And sometimes they'll just lie. I mean, Jose, this is one I always bring up. He blocked me on Twitter because I kept bringing this up to him, is that he, you know, Jeanine Añez, when she took over in Bolivia, the coup, she was a dictator. Right? I mean, there's by any reasonable definition, she was a dictator. But he referred to her explicitly in some interview as a democracy, as Bolivia under Añez as being a democracy. So, and this is a guy that constantly on Twitter, he's calling Maduro and Ortega dictators, you know. And then he refers to Jeanine Añez as being head of a democratic government, just preposterous. So something they do often lie, like that is just a lie, straight up lie. So they do lie, but they also mislead. And I would say mainly they mislead, but it has the same devastating effect though.
And you can still, having said all that, you can still find little nuggets, little bits of crucial information. So, for example, in your book, you do quote a United Nations official who is extremely critical of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. I think De Sayas is his surname.
Alfred Zayas, yeah. Yeah, the independent rapporteurs, in general, like Nils Melsner has done great work around Assange's case. Alina Duhan recently did a very detailed expose on the sanctions. So
the Palestine rapporteurs are always getting in trouble too, since Richard Falk, or maybe even before, they're always getting fired.
But like you said, who knows how long that'll last? But for now, they are bucking the trend. You know, they are a thorn in the side. I hope it lasts. I hope it expands. But there are people that you have to look for them. And that's the important of a test case, of a case study, is that, you know, you can see the patterns, and hopefully if you see enough of the patterns, see enough of the way they operate, you can, even if you have, you know, apply that elsewhere, you know, hopefully, I mean, but you have to do the work. You have to look into it. You have to look into each area, where, you know, each country that you're studying, you have to do the work to get the details, but at least you'll have kind of a framework or an approach that'll be useful if you can look at a case study like Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, I've mentioned this before, of course, you're extremely critical of the mainstream media and the coverage that it provides on Venezuela. And you examine the work of the Guardian journalist Rory Carroll, who covered Venezuela between 2006 and 2012. Why did you decide on this approach? And what can you tell our audience about Rory Carroll? What was looking at his coverage of Venezuela, from Venezuela during those years, tell us about the broader mainstream media coverage on Venezuela?
So can I start, Joe? Just to start, like there's some very hateful people in the Wall Street Journal. There's Maria Anastasia O'Grady or whatever, The Economist, right? There's like extremely hateful people we could easily have just covered. But we kind of go, again, this is just the way Chomsky operates too, right? It's like we kind of go on the assumption that Wall Street Journal readers are not, you know, they're not even potential Chavistas, right? But the Guardian is, right? Like the Guardian readers are, they get the paper thinking that this is the left-wing paper. You know, they get the paper thinking that this is the party, this is the Labour Party of the UK and like pro-Palestine, and like that's where they go. Like that's their go-to is the Guardian, right? They're like, I want to read George Monbiot, and I want to read, I don't know who these people are. I honestly don't read it that much. You know, I'm not from the UK either, so it's not really like my thing, but you get the sense that, you know, and so when the Guardian is so bad on Venezuela, you just get this sense, it's like this is the gate, right? Like this is the gatekeeper. Like these are the people that are making sure that potential allies in the West are against positive, you know, change, or like against movements and meaningful movements in the third world. And like that's the reason you know, we give the Guardian such a hard time, is because of its role. You know, it's got the most perfect ironic name, right? It's that they are the Guardian. Like they're the guardian of the status quo against potential challenges from the left, and they do that by co-optation. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go on. I can hand it over to Joe now.
Sure. Yeah, exactly what Justin said. It's not only that, it's like while the Guardian was running, it's important to note that while the Guardian is running Rory Carroll, now he's what's significant is that he's writing about Chavismo, like you said, from 2006 to 2012, basically the glory years of Chavismo, when it was at its strongest, delivering the most positive gains, and he still was relentless in portraying it as an authoritarian disaster. Often by insinuation, but still unmistakably, it's what we go through over and over again, that the project is authoritarian, it's ridiculous, it's failing, and it just an onslaught. And he dominated the Guardians coverage. I mean, he was, if you look just by the numbers, I mean, because the Guardian has, you know, they have people who are writing from the other perspective. You know, they have Mark Weisbrot, for example, and who at that time were in the Guardian a lot, and other people writing from the opposite, totally opposite perspective as Carol. But Carol's articles, like, they were like something like 85% of the content, or it was a very high percentage. It was basically him by volume. So he was relentless. It had the guise of a news article, which was, you know, which comes across to people as more of an objective statement, not like as opposed to an op-ed, an opinion piece. And he was extremely well regarded. You know, when he wrote his book Comandante, which we talk about we kind of do a little bit of review of in our book. You know, he got rave reviews from people across the spectrum, you know, just all over the place. You know, The Economist, The Washington, everywhere you could look, there was nothing but praise for his book all across the media spectrum. So that's why it was important, I think, to single him out just to show that. I think we have one part where we say, you know, you read Carol, you read them all. You know, you basically read the whole Western media. You know, he pretty much sums up all the tropes, and it laid the foundation, you know, more ominously. This, you know, it seems kind of somewhat harmless in a way at the time, because, you know, like I said, he wrote at a time when Chavismo was at its strongest and delivering all these gains. But this kind of coverage, this is what led the foundation for the more intense demonization that came afterwards, and that led to all this horrific sanctions and all the threats, possibly even of invasion. This is where the groundwork was laid for all that.
Yeah. And that's that. The Guardian historically had some very good journalists in Latin America covering the region. Richard Gott actually put out one of the first, published one of the first books on Venezuela in 1999, if I remember correctly. And it was one of the few books available at the time, and I read it and I was like, okay, this is really interesting what's taking place in Venezuela. So the stat that you guys provided in terms of what Gott and Westbrook were published and then what Carroll was allowed to publish, I mean, as Joe said, I think it's something like 85% or 80% is what Rory Carroll was able to publish. And he sort of became the voice on Venezuela for The Guardian.
And that's the way the media works, you know, it's through tokenism. It's not by, you know, a small amount of dissent here and there can actually do a lot to make it look better than it is, you know. And and now The Guardian's actually gotten worse, you know, because now you don't even see Weisbrot and those. They've gotten even worse than they were. And it's funny, and it seems to me, at least in the States, it's that to some extent that the right-wing media has actually taken advantage of the fact that the liberal media has gotten so reactionary. It's almost like the in some aspects of sometimes Fox News is actually providing a little bit of an opening for people like, you know, Max Blumenthal will go on, or Tanya Peronpo once talk about Venezuela, or, you know, and the love Iron Mate, you know, so they'll give other people a little bit of an opening, just a little bit, and say, look, you know, Fox News, that, you know, it leads people to another blind alley, you know. So that's the way the media works. It's through tokenism, you know. But yeah, I just did a Twitter thread on God. I found an old book of my dad's written by Richard Gott about guerrilla movements in Latin America, and I went to the chapter on Venezuela and did a thread on the guerrilla movements that were active during the Punto Fijo era. And it's very interesting, because a lot of these old guerrillas became super reactionaries. Not all of them, but a lot of them became just ridiculous reactionaries later on, and total opponents of Chavismo.
Yes. Now, you both end your work providing some brief comments on Colombia, noting the devastating civil war the country lived through for several decades. You write, and I quote, "If the United States succeeds in Venezuela, the success will look something like Colombia, a multi-generational civil war, the exclusion of the majority, the murder of social leaders, and the reconfiguration of the economy for the benefit of the United States and the local elite." Could you elaborate?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like my motivation, why I got interested in Venezuela in the first place in the early 2000s, because I was, I guess you could say I was a Colombia activist back then. And, you know, there was this Colombian, there was this other Colombian activist, like a Colombian, not a Colombia activist, but a Colombian, Hector Mondragon. And he said, something in a presentation about this Plan Colombia. There was this Plan Colombia where like the US provided some $1.5 billion, but like there were 4 billion or so other Colombian dollars that were supplied to this plan to have all these military helicopters to, you know, expand the anti-guerrilla, you know, military presence in the parts of Colombia that were controlled by the FARC, the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia. And Mondragon, Hector Mondragon, he said, you know, the real target of Plan Colombia is Venezuela. And I had, you know, that just, I didn't understand. I didn't know anything about Venezuela. So I was like, what does that mean? Like oil and stuff. But, you know, I'm not even that big a believer in these resource kind of arguments. I think that the reason Venezuela is a target isn't because of oil. It's because of the revolution. If there was a revolution, when there are revolutions in places with nothing of significance, the US still attacks them without any mercy or any, you know, any relent. So it's the revolution. It's not the resources. But anyway, Colombia. So like Venezuela's got this revolution. Colombia has this counter-revolution going back to the 60s or maybe even the 50s, where they had an attempt at reform in 1948, and Jorge Eliezer Gaitan, and he was assassinated, and then there was a war that started, and that war kind of morphed into the current war. It's never really stopped. Like Colombia's been at war kind of continuously since 1948. And they claim to have had a peace process, you know, a couple of years ago. But there's, you know, as far as, you know, people, social cleansing processes and mass murders and murders of protesters and assassinations of indigenous people and peasants and union workers, that's all just continued totally seamlessly without any break. And that is, you know, how they go about this type of cleansing, of trying to cleanse a country of its social movement potential, you know, its social organizational potential. And you know, the horror of Colombia, and like the idea that that's the model for the rest of the hemisphere if anybody gets out of line is you know, for me, it's like something that motivates me to work as hard as I can to see that stopped, you know, like to see that not happen. I don't want that to happen in Colombia anymore, and I don't want that to happen anywhere else. So, you know, it was this, you know, that element of like warning, you know, it's not a mystery what would happen, like what happens to to allies of the United States, what happens to you know, people that lose. Like Che Guevara had that speech at the UN, right? Like he said, you know, he's kind of dismissive of the fact that they were committing executions against you know, people who were loyal to the previous regime, and he said something like, you know, have there been executions? Yeah, there have been executions, there will be executions, there will continue to be executions. And he said something like, you know, because we know the consequences of failure, you know, like we know what it means to lose. And that's what it means. Like it's right there. It's right there in front of you if you want to see it. It's happening in Colombia.
What's very dangerous, I would add, with the in Venezuela situation is I, you know, a lot of people talk about the moderates and the hardline opposition. I don't see them as being very different. I don't think a Capriles, who's often seen as a moderate, you know, because he takes a slower approach, a more cautious approach. To me, that's just, to me, all they really differ about is when they would launch their dirty war against Chavismo. It's, you know, the Guaido faction, they think they can just run in there with the states and get it done, you know, immediately, whereas others are more cautious about it, and they'll, if need be, they'll even negotiate their way into it and play nice for a little while. But I mean, there should be no illusions about what awaits if any of these factions prevail. It's going to be horrible. So I think again, and I think we didn't really mention it directly in our book, but because you have to unravel the lies and expose the crimes, but then ultimately you have to get to a point, okay, when are they going to pay for them? Like when are the likes of Rubio, Pompeo, Bolton going to go to jail? Because that's ultimately what stops this. They have to fear consequences, because otherwise they have unlimited time, like with the embargo, with the blockade of Cuba. They'll just keep going. They'll do it for another 60 years. If they don't personally suffer consequences, why should they stop?
And of course, if we go back to cases like Chile, we go back to Argentina, we go back to Guatemala, when these ultra-right opposition members do violently overthrow a leftist or a progressive government, the end result is trade union leaders are shot in stadiums and they're tortured, and it's, there's no room for compromise as far as they're concerned once they come to power. But when they're not in power, they expect the goalposts to be constantly moved to suit them in order for them to return to power. The hypocrisy, as you document in your book, is astronomical. It's infuriating, really. Now on the and this is my last question. On the 21st of November, Venezuela will hold both regional and municipal elections. What is your reading, if you're following the elections, in terms of things like voter turnout, participation by sectors of Venezuela's opposition, and claims by the Venezuelan government that despite the harshness of U.S. sanctions, that the economy is starting to recover? What's your reading, if you have any of those developments?
I personally think the only sensible response to these elections is for someone to go there as an observer. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Joe?
I'm gonna be there during the elections, but the economy improving, that's definitely true. We've just got I've just seen numbers on your imports, monthly imports to Venezuela, which is a crucial measure of the economy, because one consequence of Venezuela having a one industry economy is that it's been heavily reliant. Imports have so much to do with their standard of living. So throughout this crisis, imports have been steadily declining, but there's been a significant recovery, especially in the first two quarters of this year. And so there's things happening that are by anecdotally and through data that we have, we know that the economy is improving. So that's going to have some impact. It's hard to tell though with the elections. You're talking about elections all over the country, regional elections. So each area, it's hard to read sometimes how they're going to vote. But in 2017, that was a big turning point for Chavismo because they swept the governor's elections in 2017. And when all the opposition pollsters were saying the opposite was going to happen. So because that's when the opposition again really started to pay heavily politically. The first time they noticed that they were paying heavily politically for being this for going all in with the strategy of just helping the United States destroy their own country.
Treason.
I find it interesting that in almost every election in Venezuela you do have international observers, and some of noticeable reputations, like the former Prime Minister of Spain, Zapatero, but their statements, and ex-presidents from Latin America, but their statements on the elections almost go totally, they might as well not have traveled to Venezuela, because there's nothing in the New York Times, The Guardian saying, Venezuela recently had elections, and five ex-presidents from Latin America attended those elections, were there as electoral observers, et cetera, et cetera. So again, it's, we're almost living in sort of parallel universes when trying to have a sensible discussion on Venezuela.
I mean, the stuff that Joe's going to see, I observed a recall. They tried to recall Chavez in 2007, I believe, 2006, maybe. Maybe even before. Maybe it was 2004.
2004, I think, was the date. Yes.
Yeah, 2004. Yeah, that's when I was there. I was there in 04. I was there again in 06, which is why I am. And I think I was there again in 07. But in 2004, I think, was the first time I went to Venezuela. And I was there during this campaign. And it was like, we learned about the voting machines. It's like, first of all, the voting machines, I think, were made in Miami, which is hilarious because they can make fair voting machines in Miami. They just can't use them in the US. So these voting machines, I mean, it's literally foolproof. Like you go and it says, you know, are you voting yes or no? You press your button, it prints out a ticket that says you voted yes or you voted no, and you fold that up and you put that in the box. So they have a paper box that they can count, and the machine gives you the count as soon as the, like, just like this, right? It's fantastic. And the United States cannot conceivably have such a system for some weird reason, right? So they have, like, the stuff that happens in every single US election is not thinkable in Venezuelan elections. Their system is way more fair, way more transparent, makes way more sense. The US system is unbelievable. Like, it's unbelievable, right? Like, they have hacked...
Even the fact that they vote on Tuesdays rather than a Sunday.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, they have. I mean, you know, yeah, like Venezuela, you can't drink on election day in Venezuela. You don't want to.
And the fact that these machines provide a paper trail, and there's a digital trail, and people are finger, you know, their thumb is dipped in ink, so they can't go back. I mean, there's several checks and balances there, but again, you would think that Venezuela has been hosting sham elections for the past 20 years. Yeah. Joe Emmersberg, Justin Poggio, I think have I got the Poggio's pronunciation?
That's good. That's a little bit Frenchified, but Podor is fine. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you both so much for speaking to Destructible Podcast, the authors of Extraordinary Threat, the U.S. Empire, the Media, and 20 years of coup attempts in Venezuela. I've said this before, I'll say it again. I think it is one of the most important books published on Venezuela. Indestructible Podcast, Indestructible.
Hey, let me say, Rodrigo, you know, you write about this stuff too, and I appreciate, you know, what you write about Venezuela and Colombia and Cuba. I don't know what I missed, but those are the ones I usually read. So I try not to miss your work too. Definitely, like, on the same page as us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. That concludes the 9th episode of Indestructible. As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, and I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon. You can do this for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode, I would recommend that you write to us on our email, which you will find on the website. Soon, we will return with episode 10, but until then, goodbye and stay safe.